rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Thomas Jefferson: it is neither wealth nor splendor, but tranquility and occupation which give you happiness. I would say having a mission in life is the modern way of saying that. It's something you care about, that you're really working at, doing because you love it. Coming up on today's program, our My Bad Boss comment contest. It's going to be an interesting day. And just so much in the news. George W. Bush needs a lawyer. Needs a lawyer fast. Might even be facing some time in the big house. Well, or at least an impeachment. We'll get to that as the program continues. Right now, Alex Epstein is with us. He's with the Ayn Rand Institute. The Ayn Rand Institute, all the way back to Atlas Shrugged, the proponents of the notion that... Well, here's the problem, Alex. If I say it, it may sound like I'm trying to spin it. Why don't you give me a one- or two-sentence summary of objectivism?
Sure. Objectivism is basically the idea that there's an objective, scientific, knowable reality, that the only way we can know it is by observation and reason, that we should all live for our own happiness by pursuing our rational self-interest, and the only proper social system is one of laissez-faire capitalism that leaves us all free to think and act on our own judgment and interact harmoniously.
Thank you. Well said. And then that, of course, leads to Grover Norquist, for example, saying that we don't want to destroy American democracy. We just want to shrink it down to the size where we can drag it in the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub, right?
I wouldn't agree with that implication.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, in any case, I think it's great having you guys on here because so much of the thinking of Ayn Rand has colored and flavored the thinking of libertarians and the more libertarian end of the conservative and Republican movement, and you guys just tell it like it is from your point of view, and I appreciate that. Alex Epstein is with the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. And you've written a piece over at AynRand.org, A Victory for Big Tobacco is a Victory for the Rule of Law. And this is the Dateline, Irvine, California. The Florida Supreme Court has just held an appellate court decision to throw out a $145 billion verdict in the case of Engel versus Liggett Group. And then Alex Epstein, fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute, says, while the decision is being hailed as a major victory for tobacco companies, it is far more than that. The court effectively rejected an assault on a fundamental principle that our lives depend on, the rule of law. Alex, how so?
Well, because this case wasn't just about tobacco per se. It was a case in which the tobacco companies were held liable for an unprecedented, unbelievable amount of damages, $145 billion, that was specifically, the many aspects of the case were specifically went against the law in terms of what is the maximum amount of punitive damages you can have, the nature of gathering together 700,000 vastly different people in a class, which isn't allowed, in the same class, which isn't allowed. And what happened was the plaintiff's attorney in the case, just completely baldly told the jury to reject the law. He knew that the verdict he wanted would not happen if they went with the law. And so he told them, throw out the law. And he did just an unbelievable amount of basically appeals to vigilante justice, telling them to go against the law. And the judge himself, of the original judge, not the appellate judge, also, he basically acknowledged that the Supreme Court prohibited this verdict, but he said, well, we have to get around it somehow because it's so unjust in my view. And so the premise here is that, well, if you don't agree with the law, these people don't peacefully argue for a different law. What they do is they just go against it because they think it's wrong. And so what that means is that none of us are safe if this happens, because as an individual, I can't know, or a company, I can't know what is and isn't legal, because any jury any time can say, well, okay, this is legal, but I think it shouldn't be. So you have to go to jail or you have to pay $145 billion. And that is anarchism. That is completely antithetical to a free and secure society.
It just sounds to me like you're spit in the face of the founders of this country on behalf of the rich guys. I mean, the Seventh Amendment is quite explicit. I'll read the entire thing. It's one sentence long. It says it's in suits at common law, which is what this was, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, which this did. The right of trial by a jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in the court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. I mean, the jury ruled on this thing. What do you have against juries?
It's not what against juries, but what is the jury supposed to rule on? They're supposed to rule on the facts of the case as evaluated by reference to the law. What actually happened, and was it illegal or not? And in this case, what actually happened was not legally allowed to lead to this amount of damages, and yet they did it anyway because they thought so. So they are completely going against the actual law as it is.
What was legal is that they could determine what the punitive damages were going to be. I mean, this is one of those gray areas where in terms of the law, where you say, well, are punitive damages excessive or not? I mean, what this boils down to, Alex Epstein, was a case of excessive damages, right?
No, not just that. I mean, I think there are a lot of things wrong with it. But no, the excessive damages.
But that was that's what the Florida Supreme Court cited.
Well, but not just that though. The class certification as well, in terms of certifying 700,000 Florida smokers as a uniform class that are all equally allegedly harmed by the tobacco company.
But again, that was just splitting hairs. They were suggesting that they couldn't certify them all as one class because they weren't all buying tobacco from the same company. But in fact, they were all buying tobacco from the same industry.
Well, from the same, yeah, but in different quantities, and they have different individual circumstances. Again, it's not a cut and dried thing in terms of buying tobacco. Because buying tobacco, there people buy different amounts. There are different brands who said different things, and there are different risks for different people. So it's in no way, it's not as if, well, the tobacco industry just sold each one of them poison and said that it was vitamins, and then they all died.
If that had happened,
then it would have been
one of the things that was One of the things that was documented in this case, Engle versus Liggett, is that Liggett was participating with other tobacco companies in a criminal conspiracy to conceal the dangers of tobacco. I mean, you had Ronald Reagan out there on television in the 1950s. I remember watching these ads as a little kid. Ronald Reagan dressed up in a doctor's outfit going, smoke Chesterfields if you have a sore throat. They're best for you. They're good for you. I mean, this was a criminal conspiracy. These people had known for 40 years at that point in time that tobacco kills people.
Okay, but again, tobacco doesn't kill people by itself in certain quantities.
The use of tobacco kills people.
Well, no, the use of tobacco in certain quantities for certain people is really, really harmful. But if I smoke one cigarette a day for the rest of my life, it's going to have no discernible health impact, likely. So the risks of tobacco, this idea of them concealing it, the risks have been known for decades upon decades.
Alex, that's very, come on. I'm just amazed that you say that. It's sort of like saying, well, you know, if I only shoot heroin, once every other day, for the rest of my life, everything will be fine. I mean, tobacco is five times more addictive than heroin. Nicotine is the most addictive drug ever found for the human organism.
Yeah, I that doesn't make any sense to me because millions and millions of people have
quit. I'm quoting
quit.
Harvard University.
Well, I don't know the study, but the fact is that millions and millions of people have quit cigarettes.
And half of all heroin addicts spontaneously quit using heroin.
Okay, well, that's fine. But the point is it's not selling poison. It's selling a product that's habit-forming, that has health risks that individuals should be able to decide.
Tobacco is the only product that we sell in our society, Alex, that when used as directed leads to death.
It's what who directs you to smoke three packs a day? All they do is they sell you a pack of cigarettes, and you can smoke it. You can smoke one pack over a lifetime, or you can smoke five packs a day. It's up to you, but it's you taking on the risks in the same way you take on risks if you buy five packets of Twinkies a day. And
so you're suggesting that if I manufacture a product that I know has the potential to addict and kill people, and I don't tell them that, I conceal that from them, that's fine because that's laissez-faire capitalism.
No, I'm not saying that at all. So it's not that the tobacco companies have done nothing wrong, but this idea that there's some huge conspiracy, you can't have a conspiracy to conceal something that is widely known. And so if you go back to Dostoevsky...
It wasn't widely known in the 1940s and 50s.
It certainly was. There, I mean, you have books back then saying everyone knows tobacco is terrible for you. Nobody thought that having their lungs full of tar was a great idea. Now, maybe more specifically, they knew the health impact of it. Now they know more. There have been more studies, but certainly nobody thought that this was vitamins. And so,
but even if they did, you would defend it, wouldn't you?
It depends. If they marketed it as vitamins and they sold it as a health thing, then
Well, that's what Ronald Reagan was doing. They were overtly selling Chesterfields as this is what you should smoke if you have a sore throat.
Insofar as they're doing that, then that's fraud. But that doesn't mean that they are then liable for the health problems of every single smoker, which is what they're effectively charged with. That's, you have to make the distinction between what their guilt implies legally and what it doesn't.
A lot of hairs to split here, Alex. It's good talking with you. Alex Epstein, he's a writer with the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. You can read his piece over at Ayn Rand, Victory for Big Tobacco, A Victory for the Rule of Law. Thanks for being with us, Alex.
All right, thank you, Tom.
Good speaking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program. You're in the real free speech zone.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
Well, you can't turn him into a company man. You can't turn him into a whore. And the boys upstairs just don't understand anymore. Well, the top brass don't like him talking so much. And he won't play what they say to play. And he don't want to change. What don't need to change? And there goes the last DJ who plays what he wants to play and says what he wants to say. Hey, hey, hey.
And welcome back. Last DJ here talking with you, Tom Hartmann. 21 minutes past the hour. 1-866-440-8466, our toll-free number all across the United States. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room or participate in our message board, our sort of semi-blog area, anybody can participate. You, too, can blog or message or whatever you want to call it. Go to TomHartmann.com and just click the links for the live chat or for the message area, and it'll get you right there. 1-866-440-8466. Dave in Los Angeles, California on the line. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you, Dave?
Fantastic.
What's
hey,
up?
I just wanted to mention on your previous guest from the Ayn Rand Foundation there, he couldn't be more wrong about the jury aspect, the jury nullification.
Right.
That is written into our law, and it dates back, it has a history that goes back to William Penn trial. This is how, it's the last refuge against...
If you're talking about the William Penn trial, you're talking about before the creation of the United States.
It goes way back. But it's the last defense against total tyranny. Up until the early 1900s, juries used to actually be told by the judge that they have a choice of not only guilty, not guilty, but they could also judge the law and refuse.
Well, that's interesting.
That's jury nullification. There's an organization out there, to give them a little plug, it's called FIJA, F-I-J-A, and they've been in existence for years. I happened to meet one of the founders, Larry Dodge, years ago, and it's a very interesting topic, maybe a topic for another day, but it's very interesting to look up the history of this, and they've been fighting to get juries fully informed to be told that they have this option to, and in fact, on another tangent, their prohibition was partially overturned because of this. Juries just refused to convict.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, I have a friend. I used to be part of a businessman's group down in Atlanta. We'd get together once a month for dinner, and there's, I don't know, 12, 15 of us. It's called the Terminus Group. It's still running. I you know, moved out of town. A bunch of great guys, and several of them were lawyers. And one of them made the comment once, and you know, I never followed up or followed through on it. But and I didn't know if it was Georgia law or if it was federal law. But he said that jurors don't realize it, but they have the right to independently question witnesses. And he said that he was once on a jury or was going to be put on a jury, and he raised that issue with the judge, and that immediately got him eliminated from jury duty. Realizing that he knew that.
That is true, and also...
is that true federally?
I believe it is. I'm no expert on this, but I did get some exposure to it, and I did know that also that anyone distributing a FIJA pamphlet around a courthouse, or if there's somebody came in and was aware that of the Fully Informed Jury Association, that they would be immediately dismissed.
So Fully Informed Jury Association is, we need to get somebody from that group here on the program. David's tracking it down right now. But fascinating. Dave, thanks a lot for the call.
All right.
Appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Brett in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Brett, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? I'm glad you guys are doing this. I just wanted to throw my two cents out about Alex, the last guest.
Sure.
I used to do drugs, and it was easier for me to quit doing drugs, and they were hard stuff, versus these cigarettes.
Yeah.
They're one of the worst things in the world to try and quit. I've tried 5-6 times, and I'm still trying, but once they get their claws in you, it's there.
Oh, yeah. Go to an Al-Anon meeting or a Narcanon meeting or an AA meeting, and you're going to find a whole bunch of people who are sitting around smoking cigarettes because they could quit alcohol, which is incredibly addictive. They could quit heroin, which is incredibly addictive. They could quit crack cocaine, which is incredibly addictive, but they can't quit tobacco. And part of the reason why, by the way, is because the tobacco that's sold nowadays is crack nicotine. This came out about 20 years ago, 15 years ago or so, when they started publishing the ingredients in cigarettes. And somebody noticed that ammonia was one of the ingredients, and they were like, why do they put ammonia in cigarettes? Because these are all supposed to be flavoring agents. Turns out it alters the pH of the nicotine. It makes it alkaline. If you make the nicotine alkaline, then it hits the acid blood. Our blood is relatively acidic or slightly acidic, or some components of the blood. It hits it really fast and goes bang right into the brain much more rapidly. It's the same thing with cocaine. If you take cocaine and you make it very alkaline, then it hits you 5 or 10 times faster. That's why it's called freebasing. So crack cocaine is alkalized cocaine, and the nicotine in virtually all cigarettes except the roll your own from natural tobacco types, virtually all other cigarettes, is crack nicotine. Amazing stuff, huh?
Yeah. Well, thank God for the corporations.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Brett. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. And this just raises the point. I mean, Alex Epstein from Ayn Rand is his point that, corporations are doing, well, I don't want to characterize his point, but the point that is made so often by the defenders of big tobacco are, hey, it's legal, I should just be able to do it. You know, well, I'm sorry that there are larger issues than that, Ethan. There are issues about what's good for we the people. You know, when Jefferson put it into the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, those weren't just happy phrases. That was a very, very succinct summary of the importance of community and government to community. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Burning up the atmosphere and cutting down the trees. The billion-dollar bombing of a nation on his knees. Anyone not marching to their tune, they call it treason. Everyone says God is on his side. See the lightning, hear the cries of the wounded in a world in holy war. Mortal thunder from the sky, killing everything they say they're fighting for.
And welcome back, my friends. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, just a quick reminder. A fundraising event, We the People, a fundraising event for Congressman Jim McDermott with former President Bill Clinton, will be emceed by yours truly, me. It'll be a pre-show event, 7 p.m., that I'll be moderating at Benaroya Hall, 200 2nd Avenue, Seattle. This is a fundraiser, so tickets start at $50, and some VIP tickets are more than that. You can find out all about it, but this is for a really good cause. Jim McDermott, it's a whole long story, and hopefully throughout the week we'll have an opportunity to get into it. We talk with his office about exactly, you know, what and how and all that kind of stuff. But the bottom line is you can learn all about it over at McDermottForCongress.com, McDermott, D-E-R-M-O-T-T-F-O-R, Congress.com, McDermott, McDermottForCongress.com. If you're interested in tickets and learning more about that, it will be 1 week from tonight. So I'm looking forward to it. I'll be heading up to Seattle right after I get off the air, hop on a plane, head up there, and and be the first time that I've actually been in the same room with Bill Clinton. It'll be interesting to meet him too. So, and Jim McDermott, of course. I remember the reason why I said that I would be so enthusiastic to do this when they first asked if I'd consider being the MC for the evening. I remember back in 2002, the fall of 2002, and my good friend Paul Loeb, who's an author who lives in Seattle. I don't remember exactly what the circumstances were, but I was out here. I was out in Seattle. We were living in Vermont at the time, and I was in Seattle. And Paul said, "Hey, there's this peace march at this big church, and I don't remember the name of the church now. I'm sorry, downtown. And Jim McDermott and Scott Ritter are going to be speaking. And this must have been, you know, the late fall of 2002." I mean, just before we invaded Iraq, and so we went. We stood in line for an hour and a half or so. You know, the line went all the way around the block. I mean, it was huge. This long line. Paul and I went, and in fact, we had to sit way up in the upper balcony of the church. Great big, huge, beautiful old church. And Jim McDermott got up, and Scott Ritter got up, and Scott Ritter told the story about how he had been there in Iraq, and he was a card-carrying Republican, and this had nothing to do with politics, and it was all about the fact that there really are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, because he destroyed them personally. And so there's something else going on here. And then Jim McDermott gets up and says words to the effect of, I don't remember the exact words, but words to the effect of, that this was something that the Bush administration was doing for political purposes or some other purpose, who knows. But most importantly, that if we went into Iraq with this kind of lousy plan that the Bushes were putting forward, we would end up with house-to-house combat. And it would be the very worst kind of war. It was the wrong war, the wrong place, the wrong time. It shouldn't be done. And so here was a guy who was speaking out against the war in Iraq before it even happened. And so, you know, when they said, hey, would you come up here and MC a fundraiser for Jim McDermott? I was like, yeah, you know. Yeah, absolutely. In a heartbeat. So I'm very, very pleased and very honored to be coming to Seattle next week. The IRS is going to cut tax lawyers who audit the richest. If you are, this is a backdoor way of closing down. Oh, Louise tells me I was on book tour for Unequal Protection at the time when I was in Seattle. Thank you, Louise. This is a backdoor way of closing down the estate tax. If the Bushies and the billionaires and multi-billionaires who fund them can't get we the people through our elected representatives to do away with the estate tax, then they're simply going to stop enforcement of it. Sound Machiavellian? Sound impossible? Sound, you know, what? They're going to start ignoring the laws that they don't like? Well, yeah, Bush has done that 750 times now on 140 pieces of legislation. He's attached signing statements saying that he doesn't have to follow the laws. By the way, he's being advised now that in the face of a possible Democratic victory in November, he better start getting some lawyers. We'll get into that in a few minutes. But here, this is a symptom of it. This article by David K. Johnston in yesterday's New York Times just lays it right out. And this is not a polemic. This is not an op-ed piece. This is just straight news reporting. The federal government is moving to eliminate the jobs of nearly half of the lawyers at the Internal Revenue Service who audit tax returns of some of the wealthiest Americans, specifically those who are subject to gift and estate taxes when they transfer parts of their fortunes to their children or others. The administration plans to cut the jobs of 157 of the agency's 345 estate tax lawyers, plus 17 personnel, support personnel in less than 70 days. Now, first of all, you get it. They have 345 lawyers who overlook the estate tax. You get it. This is a tax not very many people pay because they only have a couple hundred lawyers at the IRS who look over the returns. So, number one, you know, like as we've been saying all along, I mean, you know, you've got to be really, really rich for this to be a serious consideration or concern, number one. Number two, they're chopping just about in half the number of lawyers and support personnel, and they're just going to do it. Kevin Brown, an IRS deputy commissioner, confirmed the cuts after the New York Times was given internal documents by people inside the IRS who opposed them. David K. Johnson, the New York Times, goes on to say, six IRS estate tax lawyers whose jobs are likely to be eliminated said in interviews that the cuts were just the latest moves behind the scenes at the IRS to shield people with political connections and complex tax avoidance devices from thorough audits. In other words, this is all about protecting criminals, people who are breaking the law, you call them criminals, white-collar criminals, who are connected to the Bush administration. Sharon Phillips, a veteran IRS estate lawyer in Manhattan, calls the cuts, quote, a backdoor way for the Bush administration to achieve what it cannot get from Congress, which is repeal of the estate tax, end of quote. Johnston, in his article in the New York Times, notes, over the last 5 years, officials at both the IRS and the Treasury have told Congress that cheating among the highest income Americans is a major and growing problem. The response? Cut the lawyers! Stop the enforcement! As David K. Johnston writes in the New York Times, quoting John Hruska, another IRS estate tax lawyer in New York who, like Ms. Phillips, is active in the National Treasury Employees Union, which represents IRS workers, quote, this is not a game the poor will win, but the rich certainly will. Colleen M. Kelly, the National Union president, said, quote, if these lawyers are not there to audit the gift and estate tax returns, then a lot of taxes that should be paid will go uncollected, and that impacts every taxpayer who is paying their fair share. In other words, you and I get to pay a little more on our taxes so that the Walton family and their friends, I mean their peers, let's say, pay fewer taxes. Another gift brought to you courtesy of the Bush administration, and they're fabulously rich. You know, some call you the elite. I call you my base friends. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Mark in Rivermore, California. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom. This is regarding your guest from the Ayn Rand Institute or Corporation, whatever.
Yeah, Alex Epstein, Ayn Rand Institute, yeah.
Every time you have a guest on and you throw some information at them, like a report or a study or, you know, some news item at them, and they haven't read it, their response is a way that kind of dismisses what you just said. Just because they haven't read it, it apparently doesn't exist to disrupt their worldview.
Well, you know, I mean, what else can you do?
Well,
if you were to call me up and say, Tom, I just discovered that the United States is actually being run by aliens, and it's proof of it right in the New York Times. You can read it on the front page today. I haven't seen the New York Times yet today, so what am I supposed to say? I don't know.
Well, no, it's not that they say, well, I haven't read it yet. They kind of dismiss it in a way that, oh, well, I haven't read it, so you know, my opinion is still valid compared to the report that you're bringing up.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah. I've noticed that. Alex is not anywhere near as egregious with that. The folks at Ayn Rand are actually fairly good about that. The guys who are really bad about that are the corporate apologists that we get on from time to time.
When you get someone on from like CNS or something like
that. Or
they tend to say, well, if I haven't read it, then you know it doesn't count.
Yeah, or if we haven't already had our scientists look at that science. You know, which reminds me, thanks a lot, Mark, for the call. It reminds me, Karl Rove told a reporter for one of the Chicago newspapers last Thursday or Friday that some researchers find that adult stem cells have more opportunity, more prospects, better prospects, I think was the phrase he used, than even fetal stem cells for curing disease. And Josh Bolton, the White House chief of staff, was asked about that over the weekend on Face the Nation. And he just did the best little tap dance around that thing. Well, I don't know. I'm not a scientist. Carl's a smart guy. Turns out the number of scientists who agree with Karl Rove that adult stem cells are more promising than fetal cells stem cells, zero. Zero. After the break, your calls and more on the economic welfare of the middle class. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hello, good evening. Welcome to the 6 o'clock news.
At 6 o'clock.
President Bush's surprise message. America is addicted to...
I'm dreaming a thousand dreams. Be haunted by a million screams.
marching feet. They're moving into the street. Now did you read the news today?
And welcome back to The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. That's me, 51 minutes past the hour. Oh, my goodness, my goodness. The war in the Middle East, regardless of how you frame it, regardless of who you blame, how you discuss it, whatever, is just such great news for the neocons and for the Bushies in particular. They're using this now to try to resurrect the Saddam WMD story. No, I kid you not.
Yes, this proves that we were justified in attacking Iraq, because after all, Saddam did have those weapons of mass destruction, you know, and they just went to Syria.
Don't believe me? Here's John Gibson, Fox News.
It has been claimed by several individuals that Saddam Hussein smuggled his weapons of mass destruction out to Syria before the U.S. invaded Iraq. Now, one report suggests these WMDs might have been put in the hands of Hezbollah in order to strike Israel.
This just gets totally bizarre. It was spooky. I believe it was Nicholas Kristof, yesterday's New York Times. Might have been Frank Rich. I'm pretty sure that it was, frankly, I don't remember. I'm sorry. And I don't have it in front of me. But it was one or the other of the main op-ed guys there in the New York Times was saying what I've been saying on this program for some time, which is that the most effective way to have peace is not to start wars. Now, there are times, obviously there are times when you have to have defensive wars. But the metaphor that I've used in the context of the Middle East is that we can learn from the lessons of the Basque separatists and the way Spain dealt with them and the fact that France was actually giving them sanctuary and Spain never attacked France. Or the Irish Republican Army and the way the way Maggie Thatcher dealt with them. And she was roundly criticized for dealing with the Irish Republican Army by saying, let's try and negotiate something here. Let's come to the table. You guys have what you think is a legitimate grievance. We think we have a legitimate case. Let's see if we can reach some middle ground. And over time, the Basque separatists, ETA, have slowly become, they're certainly less toxic and dangerous than they were. And in fact, some would argue, perhaps even a positive political force in the region. And the IRA, I mean Sinn Féin, they're a legitimate political force now. And it just seems to me that speaking as somebody who admires and supports Israelis and Israel's right to exist, although I often disagree with the government of Israel at various times over the last, 20 or so years that I've been, ever since the first time I visited Israel, which was in 1978, I think, or visited that region. I visited Israel as well as other countries. During that period of time, there have been times when I've disagreed with the government, but you have to separate the government from the people themselves. But this is really such a difficult thing to discuss, because every time I say anything about this, people immediately hallucinate a whole string of therefores, which don't exist there. Oh, he said something positive about Hezbollah. They have been providing schools, hospitals, clean water and food. Essentially providing the services the government should provide in the south of Lebanon. Therefore, he must be anti-Israel. No, I'm sorry. Or, he said Israel has a right to defend itself. Israel has a right to exist. Therefore, he must be anti-Arab. or whatever. I mean, you wouldn't believe the level of hysteria in the emails and the calls that we get. I mean, some of our listener line calls, for example.
Yeah, this is for Tom Hartman. Mr. Tom, if you don't know the history of Israeli and Arab, please do not make a comment, because you said you don't know what's going on. If they invade their house and they got their house and they capture their house, they capture their money. So if you don't know, please don't make any suggestion or comments, because you don't know things. If somebody come rob your house, what the hell are you going to do? You're going to sit on your butt, don't do it. So if you don't know nothing, don't say nothing. So shut up is much better than, you know, saying something. So what I'm trying to say, just study hard and then get your out. Otherwise, shut your mouth and zip it up.
Yeah, see, and I'm not going to shut my mouth. I'm sorry. Gandhi had it right. Jesus had it right. Martin Luther King had it right. Israel had an opportunity, has had many opportunities over the years, as had Arafat. Had the opportunity to have the high moral ground. And at times, both of them have taken the high moral ground, and at times they haven't. And right now, I don't see anybody taking the high moral ground. Hezbollah throwing rockets into Israel? Wrong. Israel, an overwhelming, disproportionate response, killing civilians. A third of these people are children who are dead? Wrong. I'm sorry. There are better ways to deal with this situation, in my opinion. And no, I'm not going to shut my mouth. 56 minutes past the hour. Next, more on the crisis in the Middle East, the listener line, your calls, news from the day. U.S. cuts in aid to Africa. Building terrorism? Is there a war on terror? Is it even possible to have a war on terrorism? No. Come on, give me a break. We'll get back with that and more right after this. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hart.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. And boy, the hits keep coming. Senator George Voinovich, the Republican from Ohio, was the one who really, for all practical purposes, stopped John Bolton, the walrus-lipped maniac, right-wing maniac, known for chasing women down halls in hotels and throwing things, and referred to during his confirmation hearings by somebody who'd worked with him as a kiss-up, kick-down kind of guy. Senator George Voinovich, the Republican from Ohio, was the one who essentially had stopped John Bolton's nomination to be U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations by, as a Republican, saying he would not vote for Bolton. In fact, you know, saying quite strongly that he was unwilling to vote for Bolton. And Voinovich now has flip-flopped. He now intends to support Bolton. But if you look at what is being said about Bolton by the people that he works with now, they're saying the same kind of things that people were saying at the confirmation hearings. This guy's a kiss-up, kick-down guy. He sucks up to people who have power, and he trashes everybody beneath him. Well, to put it in their words, Greece's ambassador to the United Nations, who works with Bolton. These are allies. He's an ally, you know, Greece, an ally of the United States. Adamantinos Vasilakis. Speaking of John Bolton's quote, he is not an easy man to get close to. Some people have the possibility to build consensus. Others operate in other ways. That's sort of like saying, you know, some people believe in the rule of law, and other people operate other ways, right? I mean, come on, the UN is a consensus building organization. when you have an ambassador speaking like this. Here's Algeria's UN ambassador, Abdullah Bali. He says, quote, about Bolton. He had just had a disagreement with Bolton, so he's rebutting Bolton. He's replying to Bolton. He says, the U.S. stand that you can take it or you leave it is not helping the Security Council. It's not helping the cause of peace in the Middle East. Or Peru's ambassador, Oswaldo de Rivero, speaking of John Bolton, quote, he lives in another world with his belief that he is morally superior and the U.S. is more moral than all the countries around the world. It is a pity. End quote. The former special advisor to Kofi Annan, Michael Doyle, about John Bolton. Sometimes he states U.S. policy in a manner that is grating, but it is the policy that is most of the problem, even though his personality doesn't help. An unnamed ambassador with close ties to the Bush administration, quote, my initial feeling was, let's see if we can work with him, and I have done some things to push for consensus on issues that were not easy for my country, but all he gives us in return is, it doesn't matter, whatever you do is insufficient. He's lost me as an ally now, and that's what many other ambassadors who consider themselves friends of the U.S. are saying, end quote. And here's another diplomat from Europe who chooses not to be named but is willing to be quoted. A lot of us consider what his real wonder what his real agenda is. First, we think maybe he wants things to fail, because then he can say, we can't reform this place. The other question is, does he really reflect the position in Washington? That is always the question. Is it Bolton or is it Washington? On the other hand, Bolton says, as they note over at thinkprogress.org, he says, stuff doesn't affect it. It just rolls off his back. After all, the taxi drivers in New York, they love him. No, I'm serious. That's what he said. That's what he said. He said the taxi drivers, well, here's the exact quote. Bolton claims to have the support of New York City cab drivers and ordinary people on the street. Quote, hey, Ambassador Bolton, you're doing a great job, end quote. Bolton claims they tell him, quote, give them hell, end quote. Yeah. By the way, the price of gasoline over the weekend just hit an all-time record, $3.01 nationwide average. And I've been hearing from and reading, a lot of people have been speculating that the Bush administration went into Iraq for oil. And there are things that would cause you to think that, you know, for example.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserves, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Cheney, you know, talking about all the oil in Iraq. And then there was, you know, when Bush declared his hostilities against Iraq. And he turned to the people of Iraq, and he was, you know, his little 10-minute speech in which he said basically, you know, in 2 hours we're going to start bombing Iraq. And he says, and now I'd like to speak to the people of Iraq. And we were all expecting him to say, you know, lay down your arms. We're a superior power. We're going to wipe you out. We're the mightiest military in the world. You have no chance. Just give it up, and let's not have a lot of people die. And instead, Bush looks at the camera and says,
your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
And all over the world, people were going, huh? And a lot of us in the time since then have concluded that really the attack against Iraq probably didn't have a lot to do with oil. Because we found other things. There was the whole Bush trying to prove that his daddy was wrong, his father and Brent Scowcroft and all these guys saying, you know, we shouldn't attack Iraq because, and his father writing about how, you know, why the reason why he didn't go to Baghdad after the Kuwaiti war was because we'd get bogged down there forever, and he just didn't think that that was a good idea. Or Bush talking to his biographer back in 1999. Before he was even running for president, talking about this. Cindy Sheehan tells the story before Congress, speaking before John Conyers Commission.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend, Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I have that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency, end quote.
There you go. And that from his official biographer. So, you know, my assumption had always been, and had it continues to be by and large, that Bush's invasion of Iraq was purely political. It was to try and regain control of the Senate. This was the whole thing of whipping up the war in 2002. And if you believe that the voting machines were not rigged in Georgia, and I don't believe that, but if you believe that, then, you know, it helped them gain control of the Senate. At least, at the very least, it provided a palatable excuse that the news, that the mainstream media news could use to say that this is why they were able to regain control of the Senate, the Republicans. And then, of course, in 2004, running on the war to hold the House, hold the Senate, hold the White House. That it was all about political capital. But what if it was about actually oil, but it wasn't about oil the way we all thought it was about oil? In other words, those of us who, or those among us who were of the opinion that these, the main, the sole reason why Operation Iraqi Liberation, which was its original name, until somebody in the press pointed out that the acronym of Operation Iraqi Liberation is OIL, and then they quickly changed it to Operation Iraqi Freedom. But if the theory went back then that the goal was to get our hands on the oil in Iraq so that we could keep cheap oil coming to the United States. Remember, when Bush came into office, oil was selling for $18 a barrel, and there were concerns that it could go as low as $15 a barrel. What if, in fact, part of the agenda, and again, I still continue to believe personally that the main part of the agenda was political. It all had to do with political power. But what if part of the agenda, and a significant part of the agenda, was in fact to get control of the oil, but not to get it cheap, but rather to have it be expensive? I mean, look at who's benefited from this. You have ExxonMobil, huge profits. Halliburton Corporation just showed $500 million quarterly profit, a profit for the quarter. Halliburton was losing money when Bush and Cheney were elected. And now they're profitable. The oil companies are awash in a sea of profits. So many tens of billions of dollars. They don't know what to do with all this cash. The Bush administration, the donors to the Bush administration, they're rolling in money. All the sheikhs in the region, just they're happy days are here because oil is more expensive. The outcome of the war in Iraq, maybe they got just what they wanted. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least peace in the world. What an idea. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Victoria Jones, our senior Hezbollah correspondent with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. Yes, and I'm calling myself that simply because one of the questions that I asked Tony Snow at the briefing a couple of minutes ago had to do with Hezbollah and the fact that Hezbollah is here to stay. They have seats in Parliament. They're not going to be bombed into smithereens. Why don't we try talking to them?
Yes, a la the IRA.
Well, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah. One of the op-ed folks wrote about this in the New York Times over the weekend. I think it was Nick Kristof. And it was almost as if he was channeling my rant from Thursday or Friday of last week. And, in fact, I think you and I had this conversation. So what kind of response did you get?
Well, it's a terrorist organization, you know. basically, yeah. And you can't negotiate with them, and that's the kind of thing. And then I asked whether we actually had any back channels to them. But, of course, he didn't really answer that. And then I asked, well, what about, is there a possibility? And I think this is where I may be getting the hate mail. You know, is there a possibility that Hezbollah actually is looking for a way to save face? And, are we open to that? Because maybe they got into something more than they wanted to.
I think they did.
I think they did, too. I think they did, too.
I think they thought they were going to engineer a prisoner swap, and what they ended up was... and by the way, in that context, then you could say what Israel is doing is serving Israel's best interests. On the other hand, I agree with the Vatican. You know, I agree with the Pope that this is a disproportionate response. But that's, that then starts getting into the complex layers of this stuff. Hey, I have a question for you about pronunciations. You have a good ear for these kinds of things.
Yes. Yeah.
When I speak with people who speak Hebrew or are native Hebrew speakers, and they talk about Hamas and Hezbollah, they pronounce it with the glottal sounds, Hamas and Hezbollah. And I'm wondering if that is an Israeli pronunciation or is that the Arabic pronunciation as well? Is it Hezbollah or is it Hezbollah, or is it and Hamas or is it just Hamas and Hamas in the Arabic?
That's very interesting. I'm trying to think how I've heard Arabs say it, and I haven't heard Arabs use that sort of
that glottal noise.
No, I haven't. Not with the H, and yeah. that could be an Israeli sound.
Yeah, because that's like challah bread.
Halva.
Yeah, there you go. Challah. Yeah.
This is my downfall when I lived there.
Yes, yeah. I've been trying to figure it out so I thought maybe you'd know. Well, if you find out, let me know. So George W. Bush is being advised that he should get some lawyers in the event that the Democrats take control of the House and Senate.
I saw that. That's very interesting, isn't it? Like he doesn't have enough lawyers now.
Yeah.
Maybe it's something he should certainly consider. Very interesting piece also in the Washington Post today on the eight different areas that the Republicans need to watch out for coming up in the election in 2006. I mean, the Democrats have made it pretty clear that they're going to go after him, that not necessarily that they're going to try and impeach him, but they're certainly going to be holding hearings if they get majorities. And I think this is the question, can they in fact get a majority in the Senate? Because that's where the really cool hearings are held.
Well, that's where the real power is in so many regards. I mean, the Senate has the ability to ratify treaties, to put into place judges, the whole nine yards. I mean, that the senators do have tremendous power.
Yes.
In the United States. The New York Times here, a piece over the weekend about U.S. cuts in African aid are going to hurt the war on terror. Is this getting any play in Washington, D.C., the fact that we're cutting
aid? No, it's getting absolutely no play at all. And, in fact, I have to admit that I hadn't seen it.
That's interesting because it seems like it's the same thing. I mean, when Israel pulled out of southern Lebanon, there was a power vacuum there. And UN Resolution 1559 said that power vacuum, I mean, it didn't say it in these words, but, the essence of it was that power vacuum should be filled by UN members, behaving in concert, acting in concert with Lebanon. And we're the major ally of Lebanon in that region. We should have been, and we didn't. We didn't do anything because this all happened on the watch of the Bush administration. I mean, this was 3 years ago. And so Hezbollah, they already had a good infrastructure. I mean, they started in 82 in response to the original Israeli invasion. And it just seems to me like, stepping out of Africa and reducing
it's
our
the wrong time.
Yeah, we're doing the same thing. We're making the exact same mistake. We're saying, gee, Al-Qaeda, here's a place that you can go.
And this happening in the wake of, I mean, they have, I was going to say they have intelligence, which really is a contradiction in terms, but they have intelligence stating that Al-Qaeda has already moved into some countries.
Oh, yeah, large chunks of northern Africa. Yeah, like the Sudan, for example. In fact, that's where Osama bin Laden was exiled to when he tried to take out Iraq.
Oh, he loved
Sudan. Yeah, amazing. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, 27 minutes. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
For being with us. 27 minutes past there. We'll be back with your calls and more right after this.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Let me say thank you to those who love many. Let me say thank you to those who still play fair. Hallelujah, the meek shall inherit. Let me say thank you to all you people out there.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. On the radio support group of, by, and for, we the people of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman radio program. Over the weekend, I went to see, Louise and I went to see, with a friend of ours, Jim Riva, who has written just one of the funniest books ever. It's called The Geographer. Jim, R-I-V-A, the book The Geographer, if you just want just good, a good, funny reading. Anyhow, Louise and Jim and I went to see this movie, I'm Your Man, the new Leonard Cohen movie. It's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. You have to go. This is just, let me just plug it. Just unabashedly plug it. This is just an incredible movie. I loved it. It was a step into the Wayback Machine, and I can't say enough good about it. Anyhow, welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. Our comment line, 503-323-6620. 503, we share this with AM620 KPOJ, 503-323-6620. Give us your take in 30 seconds or less. And remember, your thoughts and opinions may just make it on the air, so make it count, 503-323-6620. Another comment from our comment line.
Yes, sir. I'm calling about the, you want to mention something about the terrorists, you know, other countries. Just looking in the mirror, see who is the terrorist right now in the whole world. United States of America with the G.W. Jr., the head of the terrorist Bin Laden's family, is one of them. So don't talk about terrorists. Look at yourself first before you call any other country as a terrorist nation. So you got more terrorists over here right now in the North House than anybody else in the whole world.
There you go. So comments from our listeners. Comments from you, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Tom in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Hey, I noticed over the weekend that a couple of the right-wing commentators, Chris Matthews in particular, are correcting themselves when they begin to say Israel established in 1948. They're now saying Israel reestablished in 1948.
Well, because Israel existed for a few thousand years before the fall of the Second Temple.
That's right. That's right. It just... Driving that point home, trying to justify any behavior on the part of Israel. Thanks much, Tom.
Sure. Yeah, this is use of semantics. It's however it is accurate. I mean, whether I would agree with it, and I would not use that to justify any behavior on the part of Israel. But anyhow, Dick in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Dick.
Yeah, Tom, I think we have to keep in mind that Europe and America never went to Iraq just for the dates. You take the oil away, and you're left with Arabs fighting over desert oases over there. But, our projects, a new American century strategy, at least the Cheney-Bush strategy, I think it changed from stealing oil to hoarding oil under the State Department influence, which I think probably was affected through James Baker, who was HW's mentor, if not his boss. The OPEC and the oil companies, I don't think they were ever going to let us dump Iraq oil on the market, creating one of those unprofitable gluts like Saddam Hussein did. So, I'd recommend that you might want to check with Greg Palast's input on this sort of question of motive and what we're why we're there and what we're doing.
Yeah, I think Greg's been pretty unambiguous about it, that we did it for oil in order to raise the price of oil. But,
Keeping it in the ground.
Yeah, interesting. Dick, thanks a lot for the call.
Okay.
Good to hear from you. 1-866-440-8466. And Will in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will.
Good morning, Tom Hartman.
Good morning, Will.
Friday I called too late. Let me ask you something. Are your brains fried lately? Do you think that the Democrats are going to beat the Republicans in 2008?
I think it's going to be a real challenge for them, Will, because the you've got all this redistricting that's been going on for the last 6 years all over the United States. Colorado's been redistricted. Texas has been redistricted. There's five or six other states, you know, massive redistricting. You've got massive tampering with the voter rolls in Ohio and in Florida. We know that at least 100,000, maybe as many as 300,000 Democrats have been ripped off the voter rolls. Most of them don't even know it. We know that this is now happening all over the country as private corporations are handling our voting rolls as well as now handling our votes and being done so at the behest of by and large Republicans. We got Republicans being convicted now in New Hampshire. John Sununu got into the Senate by virtue of a Republican crime that apparently came right out of Karl Rove's office, as far as anybody can tell. The evidence seems to suggest came right out of the White House.
Tom?
And so, yeah, I think it's going to be really tough for the Democrats.
May I have a comment?
You may.
I'll tell you, ever since I came home, I volunteered for John Anderson. I worked for him. I took 2 weeks of my vacation time. I'm a fiercely independent registered voter. I also worked, to my shame, Ross Perot, who betrayed the movement also for Independent Party. I see absolutely no hope for the American people as long as there are two corrupt parties in this country.
I agree with you, Will. That's why I'm calling on people to take control of the Democratic Party and take it back from the DLC, take it back from the corporatists, take it back from the pseudo-Republicans like Joe Lieberman, and turn it into a great party again.
Tom, I realize that you do focus on the Middle East or world news, but I tell you, we are in deep trouble in our country. And I wish you would really try to educate us. What can we do, we independents? Can we form an independent American party?
No, and that's the problem, Will. I mean, that's the very real problem that Madison and Jefferson and all, well, not so much Jefferson at the time, but, you know, Madison and Hamilton and Jay and those guys who were putting together the Constitution were struggling with, is if you've got first-past-the-post, winner-take-all elections.
But Tom,
yeah.
Do you remember Shirley Chisholm?
I do.
And what was her name? Barbara Jordan?
Yes.
Now, and Golda Meir.
Yes.
I'll tell you, if those women were alive and they would run for the presidency of the United States in 2008, they would win hands down.
Yes.
They butchered, I do believe, both Shirley Chisholm and Barbara Jordan. The parties butchered them. They came out against them, so gutter-sniping them, because they wanted to form an independent party. Do you remember that?
Frankly, I don't, Will. I know
one of them did, Tom.
I know that there was a lot of political infighting going on, and there was also issues about, you know, with, they were both black women, and therefore they were being trashed by the racists within the party as well.
Those three women, I would lay my life down for those three women, and I mean that sincerely.
Yeah.
And any time, have you noticed in our last 30 years, any time any individual, even Stephen Forbes, I voted for Stephen Forbes, and Steve Forbes, and any time
you have
anyone within these two corrupt, and they are corrupt. Now, you know, this is my contention. Why should I vote, Tom? I have Hoodlum on the left and a tailored liar on the right.
Will, voting isn't enough.
No, it isn't.
We have to get active. We have to show up and participate. I can tell you, three county Democratic parties, just, you know, around me, right here in Oregon, that I know of, where people have actually shown up at the Democratic Party meetings and said, okay, I'm here, and ended up taking them over. I mean, it's the story of Jeff in Colorado. It's the story of Roy down in New Mexico. It's the story they're all over America. People are starting to get involved. And for that matter, if you're inclined, Will, you seem like, you know, if you would have voted for Steve Forbes, show up at the Republican Party and help them take it over. There are a lot of good people of goodwill who still think of themselves as Republicans, and they need to be, you know, take back their party as well. Anyhow, Will, thanks a lot for the call. It's good to hear from you. And let's see here. Mike in Newcastle, Pennsylvania. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Hi, how are you doing? I wanted to make a comment. Normally, I'd much rather dialogue, but given the circumstance, I'll just make a comment. I wanted to tie in not only the oil but also the United States-Israeli Middle East policy.
Mm-hmm.
To put it quickly, the oil thing, I do agree. I said in 2002 this would happen. Greg Palast is correct. The people who have the oil that can make the most money off of a heightened price,
right,
are you have Saudi Arabia, of course, which is one part. You also have the private bankers who finance and hold the debt of the United States government.
Yeah.
Who also, you know, like when someone says we give $4 billion to Israel, well, that money that we give them is leveraged. I mean, it's not. We know we're in debt, and we also know there's interest on it. We also know those who control the value of currency have more to say about a nation's policy. What we have, when we're talking about these politicians in America, take the neocons. War profiteers get paid from government contracts that come from our money, which we don't even have. We have to borrow it. The people who finance that determine the policy. Those who benefit from it, like the neocons or the Israeli government, are simply players.
Are you trying to take us, Mike, into the it's a great international Jewish banker conspiracy theory here or something like that?
I hate the when people start talking about Jewish bankers or Zionism, they forget that only a small group of people, in fact, in Europe we know one family alone, had a major influence on the control of international currency.
Yeah, but...
So it's not a conspiracy of this huge sort. Somebody has to control it, right? Somebody. Well, so that's how policy is.
Yeah. All righty, Mike, thanks a lot for the call. You made your point, and we're out of time. And, you know, we'll talk about it when we come back. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program. The pill that will help you escape the Matrix.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. Truth in broadcasting for a change. Get an email here from Sandy who says the H in Hezbollah. That's interesting. I've not seen it spelled that way. H-E-S-B space Allah, A-L-L-A-H, is a hard H. She says there's no equivalent in English. It's made by constricting the pharynx and pushing air through it hard. It's not raspy, but more like a hiss from way back in your throat. It's the same H as in Ahmed in Bahrain. I'm assuming I'm pronouncing that right. Arabic also has a soft H like the one we have in English. The name means party of God, by the way. Yeah, I was familiar with that. So then Hezbollah or Hezbollah, I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out if the pronunciation in... using Hebrew pronunciation is the same as using Arabic pronunciation. But anyway, it's one of those minor curiosities. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. James in Seattle. Hey, James, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, love the show.
Thank you.
I just want to comment on your Bolton segment and saying, though, I am a little frustrated with the Democrats, you know, accepting Condi Rice, Alito, and Bolton as, you know, representatives of our country. And I remember watching the Senate confirmation hearings for Condi and watching Biden, you know, just lambaste her, but then giving her his vote, you know.
I know. The Democrats seem to keep, they've been acting like abused wives. You know, they keep thinking, well, if they're just nice this one time, then in the future these guys will be reformed. And,
yeah, I'd love
ain't so.
I'd love to see the Democrats step up to the plate on some of these issues and really start firing back with some backbone.
Yeah, I agree with you. So, I agree with you. But, James, thanks for the call. I shouldn't just say abused wives. I've known abused husbands who behave the same way, by the way. Cindy in Bloomington, Indiana. Hey, Cindy.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I wanted to comment about the issue of voting registration purchase. And also the Common Cause recent report. And Common Cause put Indiana at high risk because 58 out of 92 counties use direct recording electronic devices without the voter-verified paper ballots.
This is in Indiana?
Yes. But here's the insight. I've done some research on the Indiana Secretary of State's website, and 44 of those 58 counties have absentee voting on op-scan voting machines. A lot of these counties will also be using the op-scan ballots for early voting because we have 22-plus days of early voting in Indiana. All registered voters can go to the county clerk's office and vote without any excuse. It's no-fault early voting.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the extra tug. What I'm trying to get moving in the state of Indiana right now, and I think people ought to check into this in other states, because if you live in a county where they have the direct recording electronics and they're saying, well, we can't possibly replace all of this expensive equipment by November,
mm-hmm.
well, here's the option. If a county has paper ballots that they mail out absentee, and isn't it true that most places have that?
Yeah, but not in sufficient numbers to handle the needs of all the voters.
Well, I do understand that. I do live in a smaller county, but I'm still looking at this in terms of, is this some sort of leverage we can use?
See, here's the danger with this, Cindy.
Yeah.
In the Busby-Bilbray election, you know,
yes.
Francine Busby, she ran a whole series of ads that encouraged, particularly internet ads, but also, you know, regular radio ads, encouraging her voters to vote early and vote by absentee ballot so that there would be a paper record of it.
Right.
And then the vote was held on voting on election day on electronic voting machines, and the machines gave the vote to her opponent by such a margin that they said, oh, we don't even have to open the absentee ballots.
Right. Well,
and so, you know, they declared the election before they had even opened the absentee ballots.
Absolutely. It's painful. They were even swearing Bill Bray in a mock swearing session in D.C. So this is not the only step, but the next step is for all counties to push for mandatory recount audits or random audits. And also one of the things I'm pushing for, too, is to educate candidates. And in my opinion, conceding is a quaint tradition that's got to end. And Democratic candidates do not concede. If they are going to really respect all the votes and we have a greater and greater proportion of voters who are voting absentee and voting early, then it is not respect. Full of the voters for them
I absolutely agree with you, Cindy, and you know, thank you for the call and for making the point. In fact, in Mexico, this from the New York Times, as he fights his loss in court, the leftist candidate in Mexico's July 2nd election says he's been the victim of a broad conspiracy among the incumbent, election officials, other party leaders, and business tycoons to rob him of the presidency. Oh, man, somebody's got to run down to Mexico, get some of this guy's blood or some other bodily fluid, I don't know what it is, and get it into some of the Democrats in the United States. The candidate, Andres Manuel López Obrador, charged in an interview on Friday that the vote had been plagued by fraud and widespread human errors. He made it clear he would not accept any ruling from the Special Electoral Court short of an order to recount all 41 million ballots. This by James C. McKinley, Jr. in the New York Times yesterday. How far would he take acts of civil disobedience to protest the results would be guided by, he said, the feelings of the people. Without a recount, he said, the peace of the country is in jeopardy, a threat his opponents have said amounts to blackmail. Was it blackmail? He says, you can interpret it however you like. It's very simple, he added. If we permit electoral fraud, we are accepting that they violate our human rights, and we are not ready to accept that those who voted will be insulted. We are going to defend the vote. We are going to defend democracy. All this guy is asking for is that all the votes be counted. You get this? The leftist in Mexico, all he's not saying, hey, prove that I won. He's just saying, count all the votes. And the party in power is saying, we don't want to count all the votes. I mean, they stopped the counting of all the votes with Bush v. Gore in Florida in 2000. Maybe we can pull something like that down here in Mexico. Maybe not. Boy, we have lessons learned. Let me tell you what's going on in Alaska right after the break. It's going to curl your hair. 57 minutes past the
Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I got an email from Rich McClear. He's the chief cook and bottle washer at KUDO 1080 in Anchorage, Alaska, a station that carries this program. In fact, we're on live there right now at this very moment. And hey, Rich, if you can hear this. And in fact, Lauren on the other line is trying to get Rich on the line. I thought it would be kind of cool to get Rich on the air and talk about this. But his email, he says, I thought I'd bring you up to date on what's happening in Alaska and the voting machine issue. And this is pretty startling stuff. He's gone through the state of Alaska website where they have the actual turnout. And this is, you know, like, for example, in California, you know, people have been looking at the Busby-Bilray case. And one of the ways that they look at it is they go to the official website for San Diego, right, for the Secretary of State's piece of that. Well, says Rich, the state of Alaska website shows that 16 of 40 House districts, in 16 of the 40 House districts in Alaska, 16 of them have more than a 200% voter turnout. He says also, if you add up the vote totals from each district, they come to more than 100,000 votes for statewide candidates, more than the summary reports show. In other words, something is really, really badly screwed up in the vote with regard to the vote count in Alaska. Over 7 months ago, the Democratic Party in Alaska said, you know, we'd like some explanation for this. And Alex, is that Rich on 10? No, okay. Over seven months ago, the Democratic Party said, you know, we'd like an explanation for what's going on here. State said they're not going to release the data files. Why? Because Diebold owns them. So then Diebold says to the state, you can release the data files. And the state still refused. I mean, is it starting to get really strange here? Democrats went to court. State asked for extension after extension. What is the state of Alaska hiding here? Their final extension expired Thursday, as in last week. And they replied to the court in a 200-page document that since it is a month from the primary election, they now can't release the database without compromising the primary. Not enough time to rebuild the central tabulator file, they say, if they release the data before the election. Eh? Today is the day the Democrats have to respond in court. Now, the state gave them last Thursday, keep in mind the Democrats have to respond to this, gave them a 200-page document about the reasons why they couldn't give the Democrats this information that the Democrats asked for 7 months ago, the crux of it being that it's too late now. We've stalled you for 7 months, and now it's too late for us to give you the information. And Rich says the Democrats have to respond to the court on Monday. To respond to a 200-page document, we usually require the Democrats to ask for an extension, but they're working throughout the weekend to get the filing in Monday. Right now, he says he has a Democratic spokesperson scheduled for his show Monday morning. So Rich is on the air before I am in Alaska on KUDO. And one of the reasons that we're trying to get him on the line, I wanted to find out what the Democrats had to say. He says the state stalled for 7 months, and then when they ran out the legal clock, they claimed it was too late to release the information. I mean, this is just mind-boggling. Here are some of the quotes in the memo from the Democrats from the state. Providing the information would provide, this is the state, the reason why the state says that they can't give the information. Providing the information would provide an outside entity with the ability to modify the structure using commonly available tools such as Microsoft Access and would create a serious threat to the state's ability to ensure the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of systems and services. In other words, if we tell you what we know, then we have to tell you how to hack into electronic voting systems, and gee, we wouldn't want anybody to know how to do that, as if Howard Dean didn't do it on network television 2 years ago. Rich McClear is with us with KUDO. Hey, Rich.
Hi, Tom.
Great to have you on. I was just sharing some of the content in the email that you sent to me over the weekend here about what's going on in Alaska, and you said that on your program this morning, you were going to be interviewing one of the Democrats, somebody from the Democratic Party. What's going on there?
Well, what's going on is 7 months ago, the Democrats asked for information concerning the fact that the numbers just didn't add up for the 2004 election. For instance, we had 16 voting districts with more than 200% voter turnout.
Rich, if I may, did this voter turnout, did this excessive or extra voter turnout work in a way that was to the advantage of one political party over the other?
We're not sure. I mean, I don't think it affected the statewide races, but it could well have affected a couple of legislative races.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then when you add up the numbers from all the districts, they don't add up to the total that you got from the summary total. It was the official total for the election. So the Democrats asked for, 7 months ago, an explanation. And this has been, you know, through the administrative process, it's been in and out of court. And so now, finally, we get the Democrats on Thursday got a 200-page filing from the Division of Elections, which said, basically, it's too close to the primary election. The primary election is 4 weeks from tomorrow. If we release the file, it could compromise the primary election, so we can't release the file. So what's happening is the Democrats are filing today their paperwork in response and hoping to get a hearing in court, a live hearing on Wednesday.
Why is the Republican Party not equally worried about this? I mean, I would think that if you swim in the waters of politics and you see that those waters are badly polluted, I mean, a 200% voter turnout, there's something wrong with that, that you would say, hey, wait a minute, we want to have real numbers here.
Well, I think it depends on who in the Republican Party you're talking to. The people who run the Republican Party have not made a thing out of this. A couple of the candidates in the Republican primary running against the incumbents have also raised the issue.
Oh,
but not as clearly as the Democrats have.
So who's in control of the political machine in Alaska right now, by and large?
That's a very interesting question. Some people would say the oil companies are in control of the political machine. Right now, Governor Frank Murkowski is at an approval rating in the low 20s.
What party is he?
He's a Republican.
He's a Republican. Okay.
And he's in the low 20s. And he's fighting a three-way primary basically for his political life. Now, in a three-way primary, he could still pull it out.
Sure.
And he's proposing this. He's proposing a deal for a natural gas pipeline, which would also tie all of the state's oil and gas taxes for 30 to 45 years, depending on the tax. And so the oil companies are all pushing solidly behind Murkowski and Murkowski's machine. And there's an odd coalition of people, including many Democrats and a former Republican governor named Wally Hickel, who was Nixon's Secretary of Interior, pushing against Governor Murkowski. It's a strange coalition.
Now, if your governor is a Republican, I know Ted Stevens, one of your senators, is a Republican.
Yep.
The
both
other senator, both of your senators.
The governor appointed his daughter as a U.S. senator.
I see. Okay, and I'm assuming also that the Secretary of State would be a Republican.
Well,
so
we don't have a Secretary of State in Alaska. What we have is a lieutenant governor who handles the elections, and indeed he is a Republican.
Okay, so it would be safe to say then that the election machinery in Alaska is. If it's not controlled by the Republican Party, at least it's controlled by officials who are Republicans.
Absolutely.
And therefore, the Democrats are asking, hey, why isn't this election machinery producing good numbers? Now, this is totally strange stuff. Diebold said to the state, go ahead and release the information.
Yeah, when they saw that the website, and it's still on the state's website, that's what's so amazing. They haven't even changed that. When you go and you look at each district, in 16 of the 40 election districts, there's a more than 200% voter turnout. Diebold said, go ahead and release the tabulator file. I think they were so embarrassed, they wanted it cleaned up. But the state steadfastly refused to issue the file. Another excuse that they use, one excuse was that it's too close to the election now, but another excuse they used was that it would violate security. In this era of security, we wouldn't want people hacking into our voting system, so we need secure elections, and who knows what people could do if we release the data file. Well, the point is, our fear is that something's happened to it already, and the prima facie evidence is that the numbers don't add up, and we have a primary in less than a month, in 4 weeks' time.
Amazing. So how do you think, we just have 30 seconds left here, Rich. How is this going to shake out? Any sense?
My suspicion is that we're going to go ahead with the old voting system unless none of us stand up and say, okay, we'll vote the ballots but count them by hand. That's the only way I can see getting around it.
You mean Diebold?
I mean use the ballots that are already printed, but don't run them through the machines. Count them by hand.
Ah, so the Diebold machines that are used there are the scanners, not DRE machines.
Right. They're the ones that have a paper ballot. So you could use the same machine and just say, we don't trust the counting. We want a hand count on everything. That, to me, seems the only logical way of assuring the people of Alaska that we have a fair vote in 4 weeks.
Makes perfect sense. Rich McClure of KUDO in Anchorage, Alaska. Rich, thanks for being with us.
Sure, Tom.
Good, great talking with you.
Thank you. 16,
you too. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program. You're in the middle of the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations, my friends. We'll be right back.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartmann.
Mr. Modern Middle Class is really in a stew, wondering what the younger generation's coming to. And the taste of his martini doesn't please his bitter tongue. Blame it on the Rolling Stones.
It's those young folks, or it's those boomers, whatever. Anyhow, welcome back to the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartmann radio program. Hey, how'd you like to win a paid getaway from your boss? A one-week vacation to destinations in the U.S., Canada, Mexico, elsewhere around the world, $1,000 round-trip airfare. Or get a copy of Johnny Paycheck's Take This Job and Shove It CD, Survival Guide to Working with Bad Bosses, Dictionary of Corporate BS, an A to Z lexicon of empty and raging and just plain stupid office talk, and a 9-to-5 DVD signed by Jane Fonda. Some cool stuff here. Robert Fox is with us, workingamerica.org, the website. He's the Deputy Director of Working America. Hey, Robert.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. Great to have you with us. Working America, by the way, we should let folks know, is, unless I've got this wrong, is the kind of spin-off organization that the AFL-CIO put together for folks who aren't members of unions but would like to work toward unionization in America, toward the goals of unions, and support unionized workers. Is that a reasonable way to say it?
That's exactly right. We're the community affiliate of the AFL-CIO, and we organized about 1.5 million new members in the last 2 years, all of it door-to-door. And we give working families a chance to have their voice heard on issues like health care and retirement security, good jobs, minimum wage, things like that.
Absolutely marvelous. WorkingAmerica.org, of course, the website. And you guys started on June 19th a bad boss contest that runs for 6 weeks. So we must still have, what, a week or two left?
On Wednesday of this week is the last chance to enter, so you still have a couple more days. A
couple days left.
Yep.
Okay,
and in the last 2 weeks, there's going to be a playoff amongst the five worst bosses in America, and you can go online on workingamerica.org and place your vote or place your entry. And the idea is that folks can go online and post an entry about their boss and something that happened to them in the workplace, and then subsequent site visitors can go online and vote for who they think the worst boss is. And as you said, the winner of the contest gets a week-long vacation plus a $1,000 for airfare.
And you can do it all online at workingamerica.org. Robert Fox, in the 2-3 minutes we have left here, give me some of the worst boss stories you've gotten so far that have most made your eyeballs pop out.
Well, we've had about 1.5 million page views on the site and about 2,600 entries or something as of this morning. So there's almost too many to go through. But some of the more interesting ones were, like the boss who decided to pay the workers only for 7 hours instead of for 8 hours worked on daylight savings time, the time when daylight savings time switched over, because he said you couldn't work the same hour twice. And there was another boss that had his idea that he'd read somewhere apparently that laughter of any kind, even if it's forced, helped increase productivity. So he started every staff meeting by forcing everyone to pretend to laugh for 60 seconds. So a lot of them are sort of funny like that.
What about the Susan in Ohio, the stun gun?
The boss who threatened the staff in meetings with a stun gun. There's the boss who made workers wear a rubber chicken, the safety chicken, around their neck whenever they had some kind of health and safety violation. And then they had to wear it until they found another worker themselves who was, they could apply the safety chicken to.
Wait a second. So they had to wear a rubber chicken around their neck because they had screwed up somehow?
Yes, and they had to keep wearing it until they themselves found another worker you know, who supposedly had screwed up, and then they could give it to that other person. So they
so
spent their
become
whole time.
A rat.
Yeah, exactly.
You had to rat out somebody else.
So there's all sorts of different ones. The boss who made the nurse pass a note to the woman while she was in labor giving birth to her child, you know, he called the hospital and he had some questions. So
you're in labor, but we have a question about your
about the where's that file, you know,
yeah,
that sort of
right.
thing.
Where's the Johnson file?
Yeah, and so there's a lot of stories like that that are sort of lighthearted, you know, on some level. But ultimately, you know, we feel like this is an opportunity for workers to go online and share their stories and, you know, and realize there's a lot of other folks that have the same issues that they have. You know, we're told that the economy's doing so great, but, you know, average pay is not really going up for most hourly workers. And I think, as you can see on the site at workingamerica.org, you know, a lot of people don't feel like they really get the respect on the job that, you know, they feel like they deserve. And so we're trying to draw attention to that, you know, with the site.
Yeah, I've got one here, a pack of wolves. The company would post snoops actually hidden in a van with a periscope and camera fitted to the top to snap pictures of employees taking smoke breaks. He says, let's see, his boss actually threatened to beat him up. Was that it?
There's a whole range of them, and there's also some where workers, you know, get back in their own way. There's one that they describe the boss, you know, berating all the staff, and then they notice before an important meeting that he had his fly unzipped, and so they didn't tell him that his fly was unzipped, you know, so he went into the meeting. So there's
other ways
that people get back. But
you know, on the one hand, yeah, this is funny. On the second hand, this, you know, points out some serious problems. But on the third hand, perhaps most important, I think what it illustrates is the reality that has been lost, I think, largely since the Reagan 80s when the paradigm started getting flipped, which is that the workplace is the last bastion of kingdom, of anti-democracy in the United States, and that the only democratic institution in a workplace is a union.
Well, that's certainly what we would say, and Working America is a chance to, you know, for workers who are not in unions to have their voice heard on, you know, some of these same types of issues and to make sure that they get some respect. You know, on the job and with wages and benefits.
Get the message out. So people can sign up. You can read these worst boss stories. They're a hoot. Or if you have one, you can submit it and maybe win the contest, win a vacation. WorkingAmerica.org, the website. Robert Fox, the deputy director. Robert, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Good having you. After the break, how to get active in your community and life in times of occupation.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
There goes the last DJ who plays what he wants to play and says what he wants to say. Hey, hey, hey. And there goes your freedom of choice. There goes the last human voice. There goes the last DJ.
Oh, no, he's still around. Here I am. Welcome back. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, helping you win the water cooler wars with Uncommon Sense in the Radical Middle, 34 minutes past the hour. And time to check out what's going on with the occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the one to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children at the cannon. And there is blood on the wire.
The following are security and other developments in Iraq as of 1600 GMT. Mosul, four civilians were shot dead after gunmen opened fire on them. In Samarra, a car bomb targeting a police patrol exploded in the city of Samarra, killing two civilians and wounding 17 others, seven of them policemen. In Kut, an Iraqi was shot dead by gunmen near the city of Kut, 170 kilometers southeast of Baghdad. Near Hilla, gunmen attack a group of civilians, killing two and wounding 17. In Mosul, five Iraqi soldiers were killed and four wounded when a car driven by a suicide bomber exploded near their patrol. In Baghdad, an Iraqi soldier was killed and three wounded when a roadside bomb went off near their patrol in the western Mansour district of Baghdad. Also in Baghdad, in the Wazriya district, a civilian was killed and three policemen wounded when a roadside bomb exploded near a police patrol. Near Kerbala, gunmen killed an agricultural engineer near the holy city of Kerbala. In Baghdad, mortar bombs landed near the district of Dora, wounding eight civilians, police said. In Mosul, a civilian was wounded when a roadside bomb went off near a U.S. military patrol in Mosul. Also in Mosul, gunmen killed Wathik Yunus, a local head of the Turkmen Front, a small political party, along with his three bodyguards in Mosul. In Baghdad, the Iraqi army arrested 36 suspected insurgents yesterday in various cities across Iraq. In London, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki said Iraq will not slide into civil war, but acknowledged that mounting sectarian violence is now killing more than 100 civilians a day. And in Baghdad, the trial of Saddam Hussein resumed today without the ousted Iraqi leader, who was being fed through a tube on Sunday after 16 days on hunger strike. Therefore, the entire defense team boycotted the trial. So, what is going on in Iraq right now? 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Joe in Brookings, Oregon on the line. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program.
Yeah, well, it sounds like to me up there in Alaska, the Democrats should be filing a class action lawsuit against that criminal enterprise, otherwise known as the Republican Party up there. I mean, 200% of the people voting sounds a little crooked to me.
It sounds a little odd. I'll give you that.
Yeah. You had a guy on the last hour talking about, you know, would it be possible to start up an independent movement? Quite frankly, I didn't even want to identify myself, but I felt compelled to respond to this guy. I'm on the executive committee of the Reform Party, and actually we're just begging for average people on the local level in the different states to just go ahead and start up their own state chapters of the Reform Party.
This is the party
I'm literally an average Joe myself.
Yeah, and no pun intended. Joe, this is the party that Ross Perot started?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and it seems like the last candidate that really had any juice with the Reform Party was the governor of Minnesota. I'm forgetting his name, the former wrestler.
Yeah,
Jesse Ventura. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm kind of a fan of his too, but you know, we kind of wonder if he's going to run for president the next time around. I'm kind of hoping an Aaron Russo might run if we can't get Jesse Ventura to run. But you know, literally, I'm just an average Joe myself. I mean, you know, people can do it themselves at the local level. Literally, they need not be scared. You know, try and do it
so
on their own.
Start a party on your own.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there a website, Joe, where people can learn more about it?
I don't. Could I go ahead and give out my email address? Because I thought I might screw up our website.
First of all, I'd say people can always Google Reform Party and get all the information.
Well, yeah.
Secondly,
yeah, they can do that then.
You're welcome to give out your email address, but let me caution you: this is national radio, and you will get weird and cranky emails if you do.
Okay, I've been warned. Okay, Mean Joe Green with three E's. MeanJoeGreen2000@yahoo.com, and they can get in touch with me that way.
Okay, you got it.
Joe, thank you very much
for the call. Good to hear from you. Jude in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jude, what's up?
Hey, good morning, Tom.
Hi.
I just got off about 15 minutes ago with the Justice Department, and I ended up getting into the Office for Professional Responsibility.
Yes.
And I learned about that last week under Spector when he was probing Gonzalez.
Mm-hmm.
And it was brought out through that hearing that the attorneys within that office were looking into the eavesdropping in the NSA. And Gonzalez had to say to Spector that it was Bush that had closed that probe.
That's right.
So I wanted to let people know, I'm just one woman. I call and get into so many different places, and so often people seem to just be frustrated and talking and spinning. But people need to get off, and they need to start calling and writing, seriously. I spoke with Homeland Security quite a few months back over the border situation.
Now, may I interrupt you for just a second, Jude?
Absolutely, Tom.
Just for our listeners' benefit, here's Alberto Gonzalez's testimony before the Senate that Jude is talking about. And then after I play this, Jude, I'd like to ask you, why you called, who you called, and what kind of response you got. But here's Gonzalez's testimony before Arlen Specter. And it actually, I think, starts out with Arlen Specter.
Why wasn't OPR given clearance, as so many other lawyers in the Department of Justice were given clearance?
Mr. Chairman, you and I had lunch
several weeks ago, and we had a discussion about this. And during the luncheon, I did inform you that that the terrorist surveillance program is a highly classified program.
Many other lawyers in the Department of Justice had clearance. Why not OPR?
And the President of the United States makes decisions about who is ultimately
given access. Did the President make the decision not to clear OPR?
As with all decisions that are non-operational in terms of who has access to the program, the President of the United States makes the decision.
So, in other words, George Bush decided that the Office of Professional Responsibility, the investigative arm of the Department of Justice that would have looked into whether or not George Bush had committed a crime, George Bush decided that those lawyers would not have the security clearance to look into whether or not he had committed a crime. Right, Jude?
Absolutely.
Okay. So you called the Justice Department?
Yeah, you know, it's a little eerie nowadays, to be calling different places. But, you know, dang, I've got to do this kind of stuff. And I ended up getting, my battery's going. Just tell people to call and not be afraid. And they were so open to me.
Interesting.
So thank you, Tom. Thanks for everything
you're
you
welcome,
do.
You're welcome, Jude. And thanks for calling. And sorry about the battery.
Oh, I can't believe it.
Yeah, okay.
There's so much more. Okay. Bye, sir.
Well, you can call some other time. That's okay. Recharge your battery. Give us a call back. I would go beyond that, frankly. The Justice Department is not answerable to you and me. It's answerable to the President. But the President, in a way, is answerable to we the people. I mean, that way being every 4 years there's an election. The most answerable branch of government, which is the reason why it's the first branch of government mentioned in the Constitution, the first among equals of the branch, of the various branches of government, is the Congress. You know, Congress, the House of Representatives, and the Senate. And so I would encourage people to contact, in this case, their senators. Every one of us has two senators. Each state has two senators. And each one of us has one member of Congress, one member of the House of Representatives. Therefore, we have a total of three members of Congress. And contact your congressman or congresswoman, your member of the House of Representatives, and your two senators and say, Bush saying that the Justice Department can't investigate Bush manipulating the Justice Department is wrong. Kate in Arcata, California. Hey, Kate, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to encourage you to think about giving Bill Clinton a copy of What Would Jefferson Do and Unequal Protection when you see him.
In my dreams.
Please do.
I can tell you, Kate, I do a lot of public speaking, and there's always, 15 or 20 people who are shoving things at me you've got to read this, you got to read this, and I wrote this book, and I know you're going to want to read
it. Right, I know, it's awkward, but it couldn't hurt.
Yeah, I actually, usually look over stuff people give me, but I know at that level we are talking about actually the possibility that as part of the fundraiser, they will sell some of my books and I'll autograph them. And so,
oh, great. Well, there might be an opening and an opportunity.
Yeah.
So if there is, don't be shy.
Wouldn't it be nice if you were to read Unequal Protection? Kate, thank you for the call.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
And for your kind words. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'd like to comment on the Middle East, but before I do that, I'd like to I have a little disagreement with some of the callers, and maybe you can clarify this. Are you there, sir?
I am. Gary, okay. We have about 10 seconds, so make a point. I'm going to put you on hold, and we'll finish this conversation on the other side of the break.
Okay, I'll hold on. My disagreement is that the Democratic Party, this is overstated. There are no way as corrupt as the Republican Party.
I agree.
And we better be careful here.
I agree. Although we also have to acknowledge that there is corruption in the Democratic Party as well.
Can't throw the baby out with a bathwater. I'll hold on. I want to make a comment about
the
Middle East.
Hang on. And we will get back to that after the break. Getting active in your community and nationwide. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program, The Pill That Will Help You Escape the Matrix, 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Forget your birth.
That's how the light gets in. Leonard Cohen wrote that after living as a monk in a Buddhist monastery. An amazing piece of music. This new movie, I'm Your Man, Leonard Cohen, it's just amazing. We're going to be back with Gary on the line here in just a moment. First, however,
may take a week, may take longer. They got the guns, but we got the numbers. Gonna win, yeah, we're taking over. Come on!
Our activism alert of the day. Call your senator. United States Senate is going to vote later this week on a bill to open 8 million acres off of Florida's west coast to offshore drilling. This is not going to address our real energy needs. It's just going to make a whole bunch of profit for a small number of oil companies and add more carbon to the atmosphere and foul our beaches and our water supplies and everything else. The safety of our oceans, the cleanliness of our beaches, the health and lives of our marine wildlife are in danger. Call your senator. 1-888-355-3588. 1-888-355-3588. Call both of your senators and say, please do not vote to allow drilling, to allow more offshore drilling. There you go, our activism alert for the day. Back to Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. About the Middle East, it seems to me, you mentioned you read a column in the New York Times. I'm just curious. That wasn't Bob Hebert's column today in the New York Times, was it?
No, it was in yesterday's paper. I think it was Nick Kristof's. Might have been Frank Rich. It was one of
the one I'm referring to. If you get a chance, Bob Hebert in the New York Times, excellent column. That's what I've been if I could still want to hear. I've been ranting and raving, too. Like I got a roof over my head about the Middle East. It seems to me we're going to solve this militarily. We put, ever since Colin Powell left, more and more, we don't have any statesmanship. We put this Middle East on the back burner, if you will, instead of being on the front burner with 9/11.
Yeah.
And
no,
we can't go on like this with an administration that has no statesman-like thorough qualities.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you. And, you know,
I guess I'm done.
Okay, thanks a lot, Gary.
Okay.
We are all hoping that Condi Rice has some success over there, but you know everything that's happened up to this point, including the last couple of years of benign neglect, indicate that she won't, and that in fact perhaps her agenda is the exact opposite. And whether it's a rapture-driven agenda, or whether it's a corporatist-driven agenda, or whether it's some weird military-industrial complex-driven agenda, or what, I just don't know. I don't know. I know all the conspiracy theories. I don't know. What I do know is that short of bringing people absolutely to their knees, like nuking their cities like we did in Japan, or burning their cities to the ground like we did in Germany in World War II, you do not bomb people into submission. And that kind of warfare, that kind of massive civilian, intentional civilian casualty warfare, like our firebombing Dresden, where the goal was to kill hundreds of thousands of civilians, that kind of warfare is no longer, it's no longer viable, it's not morally viable, it's not legal any longer. After World War II, the nations of the world got together and said, that's it, we're not doing that anymore. And it's interesting that all the calls for peace are coming out of Europe. After Europe being for a couple of thousand years basically the source of most warfare around the world, I think finally the Europeans got so badly beaten up in two world wars, they said, enough of this stuff. And so if you're not going to bomb people into absolute, total, wiped out, you know, half the population dead and the rest of them suffering from cholera plagues kind of submission, if you're not going to be able to do that, and they're not, the Israelis are not, we are not, that's not going to happen. Then what does happen? What does happen is you bomb them enough to really, really anger them, and you end up making more terrorists than you kill. That's exactly what we're doing in Iraq. It's exactly what it's the when the guys say, hey, you know, in Vietnam we should have bombed them back to this donut. You know, they're right in a technical sense. I mean, if we had, you know, gone in and killed, say, three-quarters of the civilian population or even half of the civilian population, then perhaps the remainder would have said, hey, you know, just give us peace and we'll accept any form of government. No problem. but it doesn't make a right. And frankly, it wasn't an option during the time of Vietnam because this was post-World War II. These guys, they're lost in this Dr. Strangelove world. By the way, back to my pronunciation here. Sandy sent me another note. Thank you, Sandy. Sandy, the guy. He says, this is how you pronounce the Arabic H sound. He, by the way, he learned Arabic in the Marine Corps. He says, imagine you're trying to clean your glasses and you want to fog them up a bit. Hold your hand in front of your mouth and open your mouth wide. When you go to fog your glasses, basically it would be like this. Right? So it would be Hamas. Hezbollah. Rather than Hamas, which is the KH sound, which he said there's also that sound in Arabic. And that's the Hebrew pronunciation. So apparently if you hear somebody say Hamas, it's Arabic. And if you hear somebody say Hamas, it's Hebrew. Interesting. I'm just trying to sort this out. Because every now and then you hear these people talking on radio and television, and it's like, you know, where are they coming from? What's this all about? Maybe a clue. I don't know. 56 minutes past the hour. Well, we're wrapping up the show here. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for being with us today. Coming up on the next program, Senator Byron Dorgan here on his new book, Take This Job and Shove It, How Corporate Greed and Brain-Dead Politics Are Selling Out America. And Aaron Brooke and I are going to debate, was Ken Lay a corporate saint or a corporate sinner? That and more, and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program. Remember, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.